The internet is a thinking technology. So people who come of age primarily through books, primarily through printed material, they learn how to think and how to interact with ideas and language in one particular way. And people who come of age online and learn how to interact with ideas online, they develop very different patterns of thinking and different patterns of relating to ideas. And so I look at five particular ways that the technology of the internet itself, not necessarily particular websites, particular apps, but the technology itself, how it can cultivate in us patterns of thinking about ourselves, about thinking about each other, thinking about God, that result in attitudes and behaviors and worldviews that are contrary to Christian wisdom. Things like outrage, things like boredom and meaninglessness, things like the shame and cancel culture, and kind of this almost rootlessness, this kind of sense of people are calling for my attention, but I feel distracted. So I look at what does the Bible say about those particular experiences and what are ways that Christians can navigate being in a technological age with the wisdom that Scripture gives us.
The internet is a tool that almost everyone uses on a daily basis. But what effect does it have on us, especially in the area of Christian discipleship? How have digital devices transformed the way that communities and churches function? And what challenges do these technologies pose for us as individuals seeking to follow Jesus? Samuel James is the author of the book, Digital Liturgies, Rediscovering Christian Wisdom in a Digital Age. And in this discussion, we talk about strategies for faithful discipleship in the age of the internet. This is a fascinating discussion. I hope you'll enjoy it, and I'll be back at the end with some closing comments. Well, Samuel, thank you for being on Theology for the People.
Thanks, Nick. Great to be here.
Samuel, you've written a book. It's called Digital Liturgies, Rediscovering Christian Wisdom in an Online Age. I think this is a really relevant topic just because all of us, it's pretty difficult to not be using technology, and it's important to think about how it influences us. And so excited to hear more from you on this topic and introduce it to our listeners. But first, would you please just tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're involved in ministry-wise?
Yeah, so I live in Louisville, Kentucky with my wife of 8 years and our three kids. We are members at Third Avenue Baptist Church here in Louisville. And for the last 6.5 years, I've worked at Crossway as an acquisitions editor and a developmental editor. And for most of the past 10 years, been writing in some capacity, either for a blog or a newsletter or for websites like TGC and things like that. So been thinking in this direction for quite a while, but yeah, this is my first real book. So been fun to have every part of the process and get to enjoy talking about it.
That's cool. So you are an acquisitions editor. Does that mean that you kind of like acquired yourself, or did you have to apply to somebody else?
Yeah. So the way things work at Crossway, we don't just get to rubber stamp our own book ideas. So there's colleagues who have to kind of take point on that. But I've been in acquisitions for about 6.5 years and been able to work with some wonderful authors, and Crossway is just an amazing environment and such a ministry-minded place. So that's been such a good experience. And obviously getting, 6.5 years, well, not quite 6.5, but about 5.5 to 6 years of experience before the book of being in the publishing industry has been really helpful, just to kind of know what to expect a little bit and be able to interact with editors and things like that a little bit more knowledgeably. So that was super helpful. But yeah, there's a whole process we have to go through, even employees.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I noticed that you have an endorsement on your book from Timothy Keller. Mm-hmm. That's a big deal. Yeah. So obviously that was before Dr. Keller passed away. I'm just curious, is there any story behind it?
So not really. Tim reached out to me just a little bit before endorsement requests went out for the book. And he had been reading my newsletter on Substack. And I think he maybe had seen something else that I had written for another website and kind of just followed me to the newsletter. And he was just offering a really brief note of encouragement and introduction. And, I was floored that, he would reach out to do that, especially a man with so much to think about as he did. And then in the middle of cancer treatments, for him to just take time out of his life and reach out to somebody who, you know, didn't even register on the radar of you know, evangelicalism was just very, very encouraging. And I asked him if he'd be willing to endorse the book, and he was just so kind and generous. And that, honestly, when I look at the book and I see his name in the endorsement, I mean, that is an enormous privilege, and just a very, very grateful for that. And yeah, I wish I could thank him again for it, but I will soon enough.
Yeah. Amen. So tell us a little bit about the book, like the concept behind it, and maybe is there a backstory to like why you wrote this, things that you've been engaging with and thinking about that led you to want to write on this topic?
Yeah. So I distinctly remember where I was. It was the summer of 2020, and I had just finished Nicholas Carr's book, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. If your listeners aren't familiar with that book, I would highly recommend it. If you have a choice between reading Digital Liturgies or that book, you should read that book, because it is a truly paradigm shifting work. It was published in 2010, so it was actually written before the dominance of the smartphone era. And I think few books of social science that I've ever read have ever aged as well as that one has. But I finished reading that book. I was on the patio of my in-law's house, and I put that book down, and I just realized that almost no one I knew in Christian and evangelical circles was talking about this book. If for some reason it had come out in 2010, been a finalist for the Pulitzer, but had just not really appeared on the radar of most Christian people who were talking about media. The overwhelming majority of kind of like technological conversation, particularly the internet at the time, was about content and just, you know, avoiding certain kinds of content and how to protect yourself and how to build up accountability and things like that. All good conversations, but none of which was talking about kind of the intrinsic power of the internet to kind of create in us patterns of thinking and feeling that might be contrary to Christianity and the gospel. So realizing that really no one was taking Nicholas Carr's observations and kind of putting them in conversation with theology was what made me want to do that, basically just to kind of put this book in the context of a Christian anthropology, because I think there's so much that he uncovered just from a secular standpoint that Christian theology explains and has a more compelling explanation of why human beings react to technology the way that they do. So yeah, it was just the realization one day that nobody was really taking this work and making it talk to theology that made me want to do this.
Mm. Yeah, that's an awesome backstory to this. So maybe could you summarize in just a couple sentences his work and then summarize your work in this book and help us understand how you kind of took it and applied Christian theology to it?
Yeah. So Nicholas Carr argues in his book that the internet is a thinking technology, what he calls an intellectual technology, that creates different kinds of thinking in its users. So people who come of age primarily through books, primarily through printed material, they learn how to think and how to interact with ideas and language in one particular way. And people who come of age online and learn how to interact with ideas online, they develop very different patterns of thinking and different patterns of relating to ideas. And so he talks about that in various manifestations of what the internet-shaped brain looks like. And so Digital Liturgies kind of takes that basic idea, but expands it to kind of the range of Christian experience. So in the book, I look at five particular ways that the technology of the internet itself, not necessarily particular websites, particular apps, particular manifestations of this technology, but the technology itself, how it can cultivate in us patterns of thinking about ourselves, about thinking about each other, thinking about God, that result in attitudes and behaviors and worldviews that are contrary to Christian wisdom. So I look at five avenues of that in particular, things like outrage, things like boredom and meaninglessness, things like the shame and cancel culture, and kind of this almost rootlessness, this kind of sense of you know, people are calling for my attention, but I feel distracted. I feel like my attention is in multiple places at once. So I kind of look at what does the Bible say about those particular experiences and what are ways that Christians can navigate being in a technological age with the wisdom that scripture gives us. This is not a throw out your phone and delete your accounts book. This is a book that says, hey, the internet age is here to stay. We have to reckon with it, and we have to take it seriously for what it is. So what are the thought patterns that we have to be aware of? And what are the new thought patterns that we have to adapt, which are not really new, but biblical, but new for us as we try to navigate a digital world?
Yeah, that's really good. So tell us a little bit about, you use the word liturgy. Why do you use that word? What do you mean by it?
Yeah, so I've been very impacted by James K. A. Smith's work on what he calls cultural liturgies and his observation, you know, going back to the mid-2000s and the book Desiring the Kingdom, and which he popularized as You Are What You Love, The Power of Habit. His observation is that, you know, a liturgy in this, in a Christian sense, is, you know, this set of practices that drive truth deep into our affections and that change the kind of people that we are. The power of, you know, for example, the call to worship, the scripture reading, the prayer of confession, the preaching of the word, the singing of songs, all these practices are basically taking the same idea, but they're pressing it into our emotions, they're pressing it into our affections in a very concrete way. It's those habits. It's not just beliefs that create habits, it's habits that create beliefs. And so what I do is I look at the internet as a environment, a thinking and a feeling environment that constitutes what James K. Smith would call a secular liturgy. So there are secular ways of pressing secular ideas into our hearts. And his famous example is the shopping mall. You go into the shopping mall and it's not one person standing at the front of the shopping mall telling you that materialism is true or telling you that you will be more happy if you buy this product. Instead, it's advertisements and mannequins and music and colorful ways of attracting your attention and engaging your emotions that tell your heart you will be happy if you buy this. And so the internet is the same thing. The internet is this environment that commends a set of practices, a set of intellectual and emotional and spiritual habits that shape us into certain kinds of people. And so that's what the book is organized around, five different practices, five different liturgies that are intrinsic to the internet that are shaping us as we immerse ourselves in them.
Mm. Yeah, I loved Desiring the Kingdom by James K. Smith. When I talk to people, I tend to tell them that they should read that, as it is a little bit more difficult than You Are What You Love, but I really think it's a better book. And it's worth working through any kind of difficult, you know, more complex language that's found in that book as opposed to, and he talks in there. Yeah. He mentions the stadium. That's another one he mentions, and the university as being like places where you can see it. There's a cultural liturgy, right? The shapes of the buildings, the whole process that you go through, the clothing that you wear, there's a lot of ceremony involved in these things. And they aren't neutral, right? They're meant to shape your affections and speak to you about, you know, what they call the good life. Yeah, and I think that's really astute. So in other words, what would you say to a person who says that technology is really like a neutral tool and all that matters is how you use it?
Yeah. Well, technology is certainly a tool. So we don't, you know, we need to be able to say like technology is not God. Technology doesn't have a godlike power over us, but there's a difference between being a tool and being completely neutral. Something can be a tool that you can use for good things and yet not be neutral. And so that is how I would classify the internet. The internet, simply by virtue of what it is, makes us think of ourselves in particular ways. And the one way in which I really home in on in the book is the idea of disembodiment. So particularly for people who have grown up online, they have grown to develop the sense of identity that is entirely disconnected from their physical bodies. They've learned to have friendships in online spaces. They've learned to encounter new places and new experiences online. So there's this sense of who I am that is totally independent from where I am, from the body I inhabit, from the family that I'm in. The internet is essentially a physical boundary escape machine. It's this way to live everywhere and do everything all at once. And so when you take a technology that does that and kind of presents us with that mode of living, it's inevitable that we're going to develop a certain sense of who we are based on that technology. And this was, you know, Marshall McLuhan and Neil Postman were two media theorists in the 20th century who both said, you know, the medium is the message. That's Marshall McLuhan's, you know, famous sentence. And what he meant by that is the technological device itself, independent of what it is used for, is actually affecting people. It's creating a world in its image, independent of what its users are trying to get it to do. That's not to say what the users are trying to get it to do is irrelevant or unimportant, but it's to say that the technology actually has a mind of its own. It creates a plausibility structure in itself. And I think that's true of the internet. And so when people say, well, isn't the internet just neutral? Well, I'll say the fact that it can be used for good and bad does not necessarily mean that it's neutral, because the internet, simply by virtue of what it is, it invites us to look at ourselves, to look at the world, to even look at the ideas of truth very differently. We are internet-shaped people. This is partly why I lean so much on Nicholas Carr's observation, which was, regardless of whether you intend to or not, as you engage with ideas on the internet, your mind is actually becoming more internet-like, more computer-like. That's his big observation. There's scientific research that shows that cognitively we are adapting to become computer-like thinkers for having learned on these technologies. And so we can have both sides of the coin. We can say that, yes, technology is possible to redeem, and it is possible to use well, and it is possible to do good things on the internet. On the other hand, we can't follow that logic to say, therefore, the internet is entirely neutral, because that is just a naive view of what technology is. And I think most people who, you know, I'm of a generation where I had a childhood that was pretty much internet free, and then the internet came in kind of during adolescence, especially when I was in older high school. And there's a lot of people in that cohort who can kind of remember a childhood without the internet. And then they kind of can track, you know, when they first got online and first social media and everything like that. I think people of that cohort can testify that, yes, there is a difference. Like, even when we're using the internet for good things, there is a sense that we're thinking about things a little bit differently. We're thinking about each other a little bit differently. And I hope the book kind of gives an explanation for why that is and how it is possible to think and live well in a digital age, but we can't do it on technology's own terms. We have to go back to scripture.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's added a lot of complexity to life, because I'm with you. I grew up at a time when I didn't have the internet. It came into my life at early adulthood. And I think about my kids now, you know, and what it's like to have that be like a part of their life and a part of their social experience and things like that. But I also notice it as a pastor, was, you know, one of the things, and I think this is actually a good thing. I remember talking to other pastors in the past, especially older ones, you know, who were in the habit of maybe using examples or stories which were false. They weren't true. They preached well, but they weren't necessarily true. And then what they would have is like people fact-checking them from the pews, and then they were like offended by this. And of course, my take on it was, maybe if you don't say things that are not true, then you have nothing to worry about. But in a way, I kind of like that part of it. I think it's cool that people can be fact-checking things, and they are, while you're speaking, which is why here at our church, I've made a point of it never to ask people to turn off their phones during service. But I bet that says something about me as well, right? And my generation and how I've grown up and all that. And so what do you think, are there pros and cons to what we might call the democratization of information access that the internet has brought about?
Yeah, and actually that's a really intriguing example. So, you know, the smartphone in particular gives an average church member the opportunity to fact check something that their pastor says. And one side of that is, you know, you think it increases accountability and transparency for the pastor, right? The pastor just can't make things up as easily, and because people can check and verify that story. On the other hand, the ability to do that, you know, it redistributes kind of the authority away from the pulpit and kind of creates a sense that almost, you know, the pastor is kind of performing a little bit to see it, you know, And so, you know, the classic example is that, you know, if I'm a member of a church and, you know, my pastor is preaching something I don't like, well, I could whip out my phone and I can just tune him out. But even more than that, I can find a podcast pastor, you know, a church far away, and I can stream his sermons and I can kind of almost emotionally replace my pastor with him. And so that is democratization right there. Like, that's the democratization of information, is you're essentially empowering people to say, well, I'm not content with the situation that I'm in. I'm going to go over there and I'm going to own this that doesn't maybe not belong to me, even though I'm not under this church, under this particular celebrity pastor's, I'm not under his accountability, his authority. I'm not a member of this church. I'm not covenanted with his people, but I'm going to kind of adopt him as my kind of pseudo spiritual pastor because I like what he says. And that right there points to one of the things I talk about in the book, which is when you have this radical democratization of information, it redistributes authority away from the top down, but it tends to diffuse authority when it gets redistributed. So nobody really has authority anymore. It's not that we've given authority to common people away from established professionals or experts or theologians. It's that we've actually diluted the meaning of authority down. And here's where we see this. We see this in internet conversations, because when we're talking online, because those authority structures really don't exist for us and we can't have, you know, we're not appealing to kind of physical credentialism and that sort of thing, it, generally speaking, people are going to choose whether they believe you or me based on whether they identify more with your story or my story. So story has become the most powerful source of authority in our internet discourse. It's no longer reasons and evidence and here's the appeal to why this is true, but it's, this happened to me. This is my story. This is my truth. This is my lived experience. And you have to accept it, because you can't judge my story, because to judge my story is to judge me, and that's out of bounds. So I think the democratization of information is, you know, a wonderful kind of metaphor for the internet as a whole, where yes, you do have this greater transparency and this greater accountability, but you have to realize that what happens to authority when it gets redirected like that is that it actually changes altogether, so that you've actually lost in that redistribution of authority. You've lost basically a common touchstone of what credibility is, and it just becomes my narrative versus your narrative. And the internet is by far the most effective vehicle in the world for facilitating that kind of mindset. It, you know, it's not exclusive to the internet. You know, Oprah was basically preaching my story, my truth, you know, long before anybody got a social media account. But the internet is, in a sense, it's an environment in which that is really the only kind of epistemological structure at all.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that there are pros and cons to this, right? Like, let's say you live in a small village, the only church there, let's say it's not a faithful church, sure, right? Maybe it's, and so you have the opportunity to still access other teaching. But on the other hand, there's this other whole aspect that comes with it, where now you have people who identify with somebody that they like, and so they're following somebody halfway across the world. In fact, you know, I used to be a missionary in Hungary, and we experienced this, you know, over 10 years ago, where people really latched on to somebody who was actually from Africa, and they just became like their guru, you know, totally separated from the context that they were in. And I saw how that happened with what I would consider detrimental effects. And so, yeah, it's a fundamental, I guess, shift that's taken place with this technological revolution. Did you ever think about, like, how would Jesus or the apostles, how would they have used the technology that we now have at our disposal? Because I would also say, like, even if you look at history and at the New Testament, you see that in many ways, that time was shaped by the technology that existed in that situation as well. Anyway, any thoughts on that?
That's a really good question. And I have to be honest, I've never thought of that question in particular. It's the first time I've ever been asked that. So I hope your listeners are okay if I kind of chew on this in real time. I think that is a really intriguing question. And I'm, you know, the first thing I thought when you asked that was how physical Jesus' ministry was. And, you know, how important physical touch, how important, you know, being in front of a person was for Jesus' ministry. This wasn't a remote ministry. You know, he has one big remote miracle where I think it's the Roman officer says, you know, just say the word and my servant will be healed. And so he heals him from far away. But that is, that's that part of the reason that story is remarkable is because it almost never happens that way. Jesus is almost always there touching the person. And so I tend to think that one implication we could draw from that is that, you know, Jesus would have us use these technologies in a way that did not substitute for physical presence, like in a way that would not necessarily, let me say it this way, because I think this is a particular millennial thing. I think millennials like me have a profound generational temptation to retreat from the awkwardness of in-person interaction into technology. We'd rather text than call. We'd rather send a DM than have a conversation. We'd rather, you know, send an email than you know, go to that person's office. And I know this because, you know, everybody in my age cohort says the same thing. Like, I don't leave voicemails anymore. You know, I'd rather just get a text. I'd rather get a depersonalized form of communication than this physical in-person thing, because that's awkward. We might not know what to say. Our conversation might not flow. I might say something weird. I might get insecure about something I said. And so I think that is a massive generational temptation for people my age. And when you think about the physicality of Jesus' ministry, I think that that is probably an invitation to us as Christians to reject technology as a source of refuge away from in-person interaction, because Jesus' interactions were so physical. He was physically present with people. And so, you know, to the degree that we could kind of like imaginatively put, you know, iPhones or something in the hands of the apostles, you know, I won't say that they would never use them. You know, that it's very possible that it would be a technologically connected early church, you know, with, you know, Aquila and Priscilla, you know, sending a bunch of emails. But, you know, it's entirely possible. But I do tend to think that there is something irreducibly physical about Christian ministry. Like there, I try not to offend people with this and to alienate people, but I really have strong feelings about the whole phenomenon of virtual church. I really believe that this is a problem. And I don't think people should settle for virtual church. And you know, people might have exceptional circumstances, and I get that. But I'm not really talking about, I'm talking about 90% of cases where, you know, virtual church is just an appealing opportunity to not have to leave your house, to, you know, be able to go on vacation and go to church, quote unquote, at the same time. And I really don't think that's what the Lord would have us do. Because there is an inescapably physical part of ministry, because we are inescapably physical beings. Like, think about how much of Jesus' ministry was physical healing. And what does that say about the mission of the church? What does that say about who we are as Christians, that Christ carried so many of our physical illnesses?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are discipleship implications of a digital world that we live in and these digital liturgies that you're talking about. I think there's also a missiological implication for them. Yes. So I'm just imagining, you know, somebody who might listen to this and they're like, yes, I love this. We all need to, you know, throw away our phones. We all need to get like flip phones and get rid of the internet because it's so bad. Well, you know, I've seen a lot of people go that way. I've seen older people go that way. I've seen a lot of younger people, you know, reverting back to a much more analog world. But I think it's sometimes if you do that, okay, maybe it'll be good for you in a discipleship sense. But what about missiologically? I mean, are you missing out on an opportunity to reach people or to connect with people? And then to your point, it's not just that this is a tool we use to reach people, but this is beyond that. This is something that's shaping people. And it's not just shaping us. It's shaping the people that we desire to reach with the gospel. So I guess I would just ask you, like, where then does, and that's your subtitle here, about rediscovering Christian wisdom in an online age. Where does wisdom then come into this?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. And to kind of go back to one thing you said, which was, you know, like, what are the opportunities that we may miss when we, you know, if we were to divest ourselves radically of this technology? I think that's a good question. And I think people need to think of their lives in connection with other people's lives. Like it's not just me. It's not just, you know, what works for me. And I think that's true. But I also want to be careful though, that with technology, I think evangelicals in particular can latch onto the potential of outreach as kind of a broad license to do a lot of things that probably are not helpful. And so, I'm a Southern Baptist and I'm an evangelical. And so my ecclesiological heritage, so to speak, includes a lot of bad stuff that was adopted by, people who came before. And I'm sure I've adopted bad stuff in the name of outreach. So let's do this thing on Sunday morning, because if we don't, people won't, be attracted to the gospel. Let's say this in our evangelism, because if we don't say this, people will turn away. And so I want to be careful that we don't fall into the trap of thinking that the potential to reach somebody with the gospel is a kind of a golden ticket and a trump card that like, if you can show you can reach one person with the gospel, then you need to be on TikTok, or you need to be on Instagram, or you need to be on Reddit. When, I mean, honestly, I don't think there's I really struggle to find a good reason for somebody to be on TikTok. And, if people want to fight me on that, then that's great. And I'm not going to live and die for that hill. But like, here's an example of a technology that I don't see doing much good. And I think even its origins are problematic. And that's just a quick comment on that, just to guard against the kind of, opportunity maximalism that I think has been a part of my theological heritage anyway. But the question about wisdom is a really good one, because we don't really have a choice whether we live in a technological age. And this is what I try to tell people, like, even if you thought you could put Pandora back in her box, you can't. Even if you thought you could, if you want to go back to a flip phone, if you want to get rid of Wi-Fi in your house, maybe that's the right decision for you, but that doesn't change the fact that you still live in a online age. And that's why the subtitle of the book is important. It's not just rediscovering wisdom for an online person. It's rediscovering wisdom in an online age. And so we have to think about, what does the Bible tell us about living wisely in this kind of world? And it's important that Jesus prays for his disciples. He says, I do not pray that you would take them out of the world, but that you would protect them from the evil one. So that right there is kind of this foundational North Star for how we are to live wisely. The goal is not to escape the online age. The goal is to be protected from the evil one and from the temptations that come from that online age. So I think wisdom, first of all, it grounds us in an identity. So Christian wisdom tells us, we're not our own. We're not self-created. We are created persons in the image of God. And that right there creates a kind of grounding authority structure in our lives. Like when I go online, I'm not talking to people and I'm not sharing about myself and I'm not doing things. I'm not living quote unquote online life. Like I have the ability to determine my own reality. Like I have the ability to tell everybody what's what. I have to embrace humility and I have to live as if I am under the authority of one who created me and loves me and gave himself for me. And that's kind of the bedrock Christian identity. And a lot of people, Nick, a lot of people turn to the internet so that they can cultivate a sense of identity. Because they're not happy with how they look, or they're not happy with how other people think of them in offline life. And so they become kind of this persona. I don't know if any of your readers will have read this, but just a couple of days ago, there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal about the ex-husband of a Christian self-help influencer. I don't know if I should say his name, so I probably won't. But if you kind of just Google those types of terms, this particular man ended up passing away just about a year ago, and the story of his life really takes a turn when he kind of adopts this online guru persona. And he ends up performing kind of for this mass audience. And that becomes so tied to his identity that negative comments that are left on his YouTube videos basically destroys mental health. Mm. And this Wall Street Journal article just lays it out bare. I'd really encourage people to spend some time with that, because that really is true. People go to the internet often for a sense of identity. So really that foundational question of wisdom starts with, who am I? What is my purpose in life? Who owns me? Whose pleasure do I live for? What can I give myself to? And those are questions that are answered in the gospel. And that's why the book really begins with that question of identity, talking about the first digital liturgy and why that kind of will shape everything that comes after it.
Yeah, I want to ask you about each of those briefly. I know that we're getting low on time at this point, but before that, let me ask you this. In your book, you identify three characteristics of genuinely Christian thinking. And I'm wanting to know if you could share those with our audience. What are those?
Yeah, so in the book, I talk about how Christian thinking is careful, truthful, and communal. And what I mean by that is that Christian thinking is careful, and it is antithetical to kind of the knee-jerk reactivity that we see a lot and that we often do online when we read. You know, anyone who's ever been in a comment section has seen an example of what non-careful thinking can look like. You know, just, I don't like this person, so I'm going to just react to that instead of really sitting slowly and digesting what they're saying. But Christian thinking is careful. You know, Christian thinking is anti-anger, really. It's about overcoming anger and sitting humbly and considering truth claims apart from knee-jerk reactivity. And then, you know, Christian thinking is truthful, which seems self-evident, but in the age of the internet, often we're willing to bend the truth either about ourselves or about other people to make certain narratives fit. And we're just not allowed to do that. The reality is that people who don't share my politics, people who don't share my theology, are perfectly capable of being right about any number of things. And so, you know, whether I like this person on issue XYZ is not a final determination of whether this person may be saying something true about something else. So we have to be humble enough to admit that we don't have a copyright on truth. Only God does. And so third, Christian thinking is communal. It happens with other people. I think one of the big effects that happens online is that we all are usually tending toward isolation. And it's kind of us against the world. And we kind of get trapped in our own thoughts a little bit. But because Christian thinking is communal, it has an orientation, and that orientation is to love and to serve and to prefer others. That doesn't mean that we bend the truth. Remember, Christian thinking is truthful, but it does mean that we have to be saying not only, hey, could I get away with saying this, but is this beneficial for someone else? Or are there people who have the ability and the authority in my life to kind of give me guidance and to call me account for things that I might say? So if we put those three things together, those things kind of help us rise above the noise of the internet.
Yeah, that's really good. Okay, so could you walk us through just maybe a quick few thoughts, summary of these five digital liturgies that you say they actually inhibit us from contemplating big truths, accepting the uncomfortable, and acknowledging God? Yeah, if you could walk through that, that'd be great.
Yeah. So number one is authenticity. And we've kind of already touched on that a little bit with my story, my truth, but just the idea that, you know, in the absence of real authority and real kind of objective measures of what's true, things online tend to become a comparison of between stories. Who's got the most compelling personal narrative? But the Bible says we're not the final interpreters of our own story, right? Only God is. And so we live in a world that's created that has objective truth, and that we have to conform to that truth in order to be whole human beings. Mm-hmm. The second one is outrage. So the internet is very combustible. It leads to what I call the abolition of thought, where people simply don't even try to think anymore. They just react. You see somebody that you don't like, you react immediately, maybe even without reading or taking seriously what they're saying. And the Bible actually is very skeptical towards human anger, because human anger betrays a lack of faith often in the sovereign judgment of God. So the gospel tells us that we don't have to adopt this militant posture, because we have faith that Christ, the righteous judge, will come again and will be king. It's not on us to usher in his kingdom fully and finally into this world. So, you know, the whole, I can't go to bed, somebody's wrong on the internet thing, that is really disarmed when we have this vibrant sense that, hey, look, I don't have to be fighting every single battle to the death. I can allow the Lord to be sovereign and his plans will triumph.
Mm.
The next digital liturgy is shame. And this is one that I think a lot of people are familiar with in conversations talking about cancel culture and things like that. But there really is a shame culture aspect to online life. And it's because, you know, in the absence of things like atonement and substitutionary death and the idea that we can actually be forgiven meaningfully, when those things don't exist, when those categories are thrown out in the age of the therapeutic, what is left is this desire to make someone responsible for the evils that we see in the world. And so that's kind of what we see in modern society. And I think growing up online, growing up in computers, people my generation became accustomed to just simply canceling anything that they didn't like. Because if the world comes to you through a computer system, then you learn how to interact with the world as if it is a computer. So if there's someone you don't like, you can mute them. If there's something you don't want to see, you can exit out, you can delete. And so I tend to think that cancel culture itself is almost this living liturgy of how having engaged with the world on these terms. But obviously that's not the world that the gospel gives us. The world is objective, and we don't have the power to cast things out. That's a power that's reserved for God. And in fact, we shouldn't desire that. We shouldn't desire to scapegoat people, because the Bible has a way of dealing with shame, and it involves confessing that we don't have that authority and that we're sinners and that we need Christ's forgiveness on our behalf. And so very quickly, four and five are consumption. So in this chapter, I talk a little bit about pornography, but also just how the internet is pornographically shaped. And what I mean by that is that the logic of pornography, which is to take something that is only an experience and making it a consumable commodity, is pretty much the logic of the entire internet. Whether you're talking about sex, which would be literal pornography, or whether you're talking about friendship, or whether you're talking about beauty, things that we kind of turn into consumables online that we can kind of just kind of enjoy in a very cheap way, that is digital liturgy as well. And the gospel responds to that with the offer of real beauty and real friendship and real joy with other people, with real covenanted relationships that we have, and we can recover that. And the final one is meaninglessness. So the doom scroll, the afflicted attention span, just the sense of crushing novelty. And so what we look at in those final pages is how the gospel locates us. So the gospel kind of helps us understand that you live where you live for a reason, that you have the body you have for a reason. What's in front of you is in front of you for a reason, that this is all part of God's sovereign purpose for your life. And so wherever you are, you can be all there because God has a design and intentionality for your life. And we don't have to kind of feel the burden of trying to escape the givenness of our lives. So that's a very quick tour of all five.
That's really helpful. Thank you. Yeah. And so final thought on this is that obviously you haven't forsaken technology completely. We're talking over a digital medium right now as well. And so how do you balance that? Like, what are the best practices that you've discovered along your journey that can help make technology our servant rather than us becoming slaves to it or being changed by it in a detrimental way?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, we'll start with the smartphone, because I think that's where, for a lot of people who are listening to this, I think that's where kind of the struggle is going to be most intense. So I do have an older iPhone that is very limited. I can do very little on this iPhone. And so I think one of the things we can do as Christian people is to look at our phones, especially as, because they come with us, because they travel with us, and they represent this almost bottomless invitation to lose ourselves in what the things I'm talking about. I think one of the things we could do is to simply say, hey, I'm going to be very protective of that intimate space on me. And I don't want the endless opportunity to you know, whenever I'm alone, just whip out my phone and be on there for hours. Or if I'm ever feeling awkward in the middle of a social situation, you know, kind of reach down for my phone to alleviate the awkwardness. I think we can resist that by, hey, like having a spouse or a friend, you know, having the controls on your phone, able to, you know, limit what kind of apps or your screen time, or, you know, just using very practical measures to kind of just marginalize. It's about marginalization. It's about putting the phone kind of at more of at the margins of our lives than at the center. And so beyond the phone, you know, a couple of things that have been helpful for me has been, you know, having my wife have social media passwords so that when I feel like I need to take a break, or when I just objectively need to take a break, you know, I don't have the final say on when I can log back in. And, you know, people might be listening to that and saying, well, God, he sounds like he's a child, like, you know, but really, I think that's what it's going to take in the battle for our attention spans, because these technologies are addictive. And also by bringing other people into our relationship with these technologies, I think that alone disarms a lot of the allure. Yeah. If we can bring other people and other relationships into how we use technology, I think that's going to tend to disarm some of the strongest impulses toward addiction and toward losing ourselves that we're going to find. And then there's just regular Sabbath principles, right? So, you know, Andy Crouch has a wonderful system where he commends, you know, an hour a day a week a year of just total offline, you know, presence. So, you know, take one waking hour out of your day to, you know, turn off your phone, turn off your email, and you know, just be fully present wherever you are. You know, take a day to kind of do that and have a Sabbath day principle. I think that those kinds of practical strategies are helpful, and they're kind of, you know, they're small, they're not revolutionary. I don't have a magic formula for this, but I tend to think that as we cultivate Christian wisdom and as we kind of invite other people into this quest to become wise in an online age, that these practices are just going to become more natural for us, and it's going to bear fruit, and we have to be willing to let it bear fruit. And I think, God willing, we can be.
It was fascinating, really good. And there's a lot more that we could have talked about and gone into. So I recommend people check out your book. Again, it's called Digital Liturgies, Rediscovering Christian Wisdom in an Online Age. Samuel, where can people keep up with you online or find out more about your work?
Yeah, so I keep a regular newsletter that is also called Digital Liturgies. So you can find that at digitalliturgies.net, and I post pretty regularly and would love to see some of your listeners there.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Nick.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Theology for the People. New episodes are released every Wednesday, so make sure to subscribe to the podcast on whatever app you use. In the next episode, I'll be speaking with Amy DiMarcangelo about Jesus' command in the parable of the Good Samaritan, where he says at the end, "Go and do likewise." What does that mean for us as people living in the world today? Theology for the People is a listener-supported program. If you have enjoyed or been encouraged by this content, please consider sharing it with others and leaving a review on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And if you would like to support this podcast financially, there's a link in the show notes where you can make a donation to support the show. Until next time, thanks for listening, and God bless you.